Welcome to the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable podcast. This show is dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years of experience. My name is Jari Bolander, and I'll be moderating the roundtable today. Joining me shortly are four of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Anne Holly, Kim Kessler, Valerie Francis, and Leslie Watts. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a global fool's cap worksheet, then discuss it using the editor 6 core questions. This week, we're creeping into the horror genre with the 2013 version of Carrie, screenplay by Stephen King and Roberto Aguirre-Sasca, and directed by Kimberly Pierce. Here's a synopsis adapted from Wikipedia. In the opening scene, Margaret White gives birth to Carrie, and believing the baby is a punishment from God, attempts to kill her, but she can't go through with it. The story picks up later when Carrie is nearing her high school graduation. While showering after gym class at school, Carrie, a shy, awkward girl, experiences her first menstrual period and naively thinks she's bleeding to death. The other girls ridicule her, and one girl, Chris, records the event on her smartphone and uploads it to YouTube. Their gym teacher, Miss Desjarn, confronts Carrie and sends her home with Margaret, who believes menstruation is a sin. Margaret demands that Carrie abstain from showering with the others. When Carrie refuses, Margaret hits her with a Bible and locks her in the prayer closet. As Carrie screams to be let out, a crack appears on the door and the crucifix in the closet begins to bleed. Miss Desjardins informs the girls who tease Carrie that they will endure boot camp style detention for their behavior. Chris refuses and is suspended from school and banned from the prom. Carrie then learns that she has telekinesis and spends her time researching and perfecting her skill. Meanwhile, Sue, one of the girls who ridiculed her in the gym shower, regrets what she's done and wants to make amends. She asks her boyfriend, Tommy, to take Carrie to the prom. Carrie accepts the invitation, but when Margaret forbids it, Carrie's telekinesis powers are revealed. Rather than being amazed, Margaret believes it's proof that Carrie has been corrupted by sin. Hell-bent on revenge, Chris and her boyfriend, Billy, come up with a plan to humiliate Carrie even further. In one of the most iconic moments of the story, Tommy and Carrie are crowned king and queen of the prom, at which point a bucket of pig's blood is dumped on Carrie's head. The video of the shower scene is played on the giant screens, and the graduating class laughs. The empty bucket falls on Tommy's head and kills him. Enraged, Carrie fights back using her telekinesis powers. She kills nearly all of the graduating class and staff and burns down the school. Carrie escapes from the fire and goes after Chris and Billy, who are driving away. Still using her powers, Carrie flips the car into a gas station, setting on fire and killing them. Carrie then goes home, seeking comfort from her mother, but is instead attacked by her. This is, without a doubt, the scariest scene in the film, and Julianne Moore, who plays Margaret, is terrifyingly brilliant. Carrie kills her mother in self-defense, and her grief causes their house to cave in. When Sue arrives, Carrie senses that she's pregnant and throws her clear of the collapsing house to safety. Carrie stays with her mother and dies in the house. In the final scene, Sue visits Carrie's vandalized grave and places a single white rose by the headstone. As she leaves, the gravestone begins to break and Carrie's angry scream is heard. So there you go. It's a great little horror film. And we're going to have Valerie kick it off with the first question of the 6 core questions, which is, what is the genre?
So the global genre is a horror story, obviously. And there are 3 subgenres in horror. Carrie falls into the ambiguous subgenre. And the reason it's called ambiguous is because the reader is kept in the dark about the source of evil, and the sanity of the protagonist slash victim comes into doubt. Robert McKee calls this subgenre super uncanny. So in StoryGrid terms, it's ambiguous. But for those of you who also read Robert McKee's work, it's called super uncanny. In my opinion, Carrie's telekinesis is a special power. It's not a source of evil. Although she can be described as monstrous in her desire to destroy those who have hurt her, I don't think she is a monster. I think she's a bullied teen. So then I asked myself, okay, if Carrie is not the source of horror, if she's not the monster in the story, who is? It could be Margaret, Carrie's mom. She abuses her child and attempts to murder her as an infant. Now, that's a horrifying scene. As a mother, that one was like creepy. And she does stab her in the end, you know, after she comes back from the prom. But what causes that horror? Is Margaret mentally unstable? Is she herself possessed by the devil? Is religious fanaticism the only factor? We're never quite sure, which is why it's ambiguous. Chris and the girls at school could be the monster or the force of antagonism, but Chris is a very two-dimensional bully. While she is a force of antagonism, she's not a particularly powerful villain. She cowers pretty quickly under her father's demand to turn over her phone, and her peers reject her call for allegiance during the suicide run scene. So I don't think she's a particularly strong antagonist. And then there's isolation. It's Carrie's isolation which causes her to eventually lash out against the students, the staff at school, and her mom. Throughout her entire life, she has been treated terribly, not because she has done something wrong, but because she is different. Society perceives this difference as a threat, and Margaret sees Carrie as a punishment to her. So any of these could be a source of antagonism and the source of evil, but because it's not particularly clear, it falls, in my opinion, into the ambiguous horror genre. Now, horror does not need an internal accompanying genre. And if horror stories don't have one, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, we're Story Grid editors, so I always want to have a look to see if there is one. And I don't think there's a particularly strong one here, but if there is going to be one, I think it's a morality punitive plot. Carrie is usually considered a coming-of-age story, which in Story Grid terms would be worldview maturation. But in the way this particular version of the story plays out in this version of the film, I don't think it is coming of age. I'm calling it morality punitive because Carrie starts out as a shy, troubled teen who is essentially a good person, but who is punished when she finally stands up against those who seek to dominate her. She doesn't seek revenge on Chris or the other girls for teasing her or posting the video. It isn't until the blood is dumped on her head at the prom and Tommy is killed that she finally lashes out. And for that, she's punished first by her mother when she comes home from the prom and then by society. Her mother tries to kill her for going to the prom in the first place and literally stabs her in the back. And society desecrates her grave. However, in saying that, I think it's important to remember that Carrie's goodness is never completely destroyed. For example, when she realizes that Sue is pregnant, she saves her for the sake of the innocent child. So there you go. I think it's a horror ambiguous global genre with a morality punitive, a slight morality punitive internal genre.
Kim, what do you have to say about that?
For internal genre, I'd argue that it's status pathetic. For status pathetic, we have a weak protagonist who tries to rise and fails. It doesn't really feel like maturation to me either. So Leslie and I recently did a blog post on this, and so it came with a lot of masterwork watching and really deep analysis and comparison. And what we found with punitive, it requires that a character be sophisticated and strong-willed from the outset. So our masterwork for punitive is Wall Street. And so you start with someone who is, not only are they kind of have to have reached a level of sophistication so that they can truly be held accountable for their actions. So it isn't to say that someone's just good in that they're good-natured. It's that they know right from wrong and they can be held accountable for those actions. And they've reached a level of sophistication and strong-willed that they could actually be a mentor to someone else. And then they choose to go bad. So that's when we say the good person goes bad and then is punished. If someone like Dumbledore, okay, from Harry Potter, this is a person who is a mentor to others. If Dumbledore goes bad, that would be a punitive plot. In this case, we have a weak protagonist who does not have a strong mentor herself. And that was something that we noticed from the status genre is that this person is going to need help. They have a weak will, most likely, at least for the status pathetic and status sentimental. You have someone who's not really mature. They don't have a lot of, you know, knowledge about how the way the world works. And so what Leslie and I found was that having a high degree of sophistication and a strong will is the price of admission for the morality genres. So here we have status pathetic because she tries to rise. You know, she's trying to fit in. She tries to, you know, get along with the other girls when she can. And it's not working. Like she's has a, a large barrier to entry here. And, you know, saying yes to Tommy and going to the prom and trying to do all those things, and then it turns out to be a total disaster. Also, we wouldn't call it status tragic because, again, the tragic protagonist also has a level of sophistication and strength of will, and then they make a mistake, which leads to their demise. And in this case, it's through no fault of her own that it doesn't work out. It's just that she has never had someone in her life to help her, to show her how to use her gift or tell her that she's okay. So that's why I would call it status pathetic. Also, for more information on the nitty-gritty details about internal genres, you can check out our post for Fundamental Fridays, and we have the link in the show notes to our internal genres part one.
Thanks, Kim. Yeah, that's a great post to take a look at. Gives a lot of great detail. And like any of this sort of stuff, we have to kind of look at the tops of the waves and dig in deeper. Sometimes we have to put a lot of stuff in our show notes.
Yeah, speaking of going deeper, as a group, we've been studying movies since last summer. And sometimes we come across these movies that have genre confusion, and they seem to be associated with stories that have an external genre plus some society aspects. And as we've been talking about these stories like this, one of the things that I've stumbled upon is that it may come from the fact that in the US and Canada and Western Europe and similarly situated countries, that the cultures have moved beyond pure survival needs, and that most people are free to form romantic commitments with another person. The person of their choice, even, as it happens. So this doesn't mean that there aren't life and death struggles, because in the US, we produce more calories than we need to feed the entire population, yet people still go hungry. People are homeless despite our having the means to provide shelter for everyone. And it certainly doesn't mean that there are no cultural or safety or security issues around forming committed romantic relationships. And of course, we still have safety and security issues in this country. But where the human needs fall within survival, security, or love tanks, and we'll include a picture of the different human needs tanks in the show notes, when those needs are unmet in the US and similar countries, it seems like there's an underlying cause that's derived from the respect and esteem human needs tank. So where the society stories live. And basically, there's a struggle for power in society, and that creates problems in getting other needs met. So my hypothesis or hunch is that where conflict often arises is in that area, even if it's not a society story officially. So what does this mean for you as a writer? Telling a relevant story in 2018 and beyond, I think if your market is within the US or similar markets, then it's a good idea to at least consider how power struggles in different levels of society, your family, work, government, etc., impact the events of your story. So it's not necessarily about politics, though that comes into it. But what we want to do is recognize the need to focus on a single global genre and to skillfully integrate subplots. And, you know, again, like, how do we do that? We find a masterwork in the genre that does it well. So in this story, where we have some issues with how it's executed, my hunch is that Kimberly Pierce was trying to accomplish this kind of bringing the power relationships into the story, and that there were issues, there were different entities that had different goals for the story. So my ultimate point is that the reader or audience member doesn't necessarily know why the story is having trouble, why it's not really working for them. So doing everything we can to tell a story that works while innovating audience expectations is really important.
Thanks, Leslie. Yeah, that's really important to get the genre right, stick to it. And then you can, you know, add some flavor or sprinkles throughout once you've nailed that first one. So that's wonderful. Thanks for that. Our second question and the six core questions for editors is, what's the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff? And that's back to you, Leslie.
Okay. For the beginning hook, Carrie gets her first period and is terrified by the experience while the other students mock her. And later, her mother, Margaret, accuses her of having lustful thoughts. But when Margaret locks her in the closet to pray, will Carrie be able to control her gift? Yeah, mostly. Her mother lets her out in the morning. The middle build, in a nutshell, Carrie goes into the school bathroom after being taunted and is pleased when she finds she can crack the mirror. And when she agrees to go to the prom with Tommy, Margaret tries to stop her. But when Margaret threatens to tell Tommy about how Carrie was conceived, is Carrie able to control her gift? Yes, though she takes control of the situation and puts her mother in the closet. Then Carrie and Tommy leave for the prom. The ending payoff, in a nutshell, Carrie and Tommy arrive at the prom where Chris and her boyfriend Billy dump a bucket of pig's blood on the couple. When the bucket falls and it kills Tommy, will Carrie be able to control her gift at that point? No. She uses her gift to destroy the school, kill Billy and Chris, and ultimately kill her mother after Margaret has stabbed her. But she does save Sue, who is pregnant with a girl.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. I think you'd probably agree to see where the beginning, the middle, and the end, it's set up pretty nicely that way. And my comment on this is that, I mean, this is like they pulled those teenagers right out of a bad 70s, 80s movie. The angst one, which is Chris, that's just looks, feels like pure evil. And then Sue, she's like, oh, I feel bad for her. I feel bad for her. So it's like plucked right out and dropped right back in. So in that sense, it definitely hits those kind of tropes, I guess would be the word I'd use. So thanks, Leslie. So the next question, number three, is what are the obligatory scenes and conventions of horror? And for that, we're going to go to Kim for the obligatory scenes.
Thanks, Jerry. So we're doing the obligatory scenes and conventions of a horror story. And as Leslie said, and we all, I'm sure we'll talk about this more at the end of the show, there is a huge society genre going on here. And so we went ahead and we're doing the obligatory scenes and conventions for a horror story. However, they do feel like they have a different twist to them because Carrie also is the victim in this, in society. She's the underpowered person in her society, but, and other people have different opinions on this. And so I think there'll be some additional comments. I'm tracking these scenes as if Carrie is the monster because she is the one with supernatural powers. So here we go. So an inciting attack by the monster is the first obligatory scene of a horror. In this case, it feels like the monster, Carrie herself, is attacked. So Carrie gets her period, and it's a coming of age, as well as she endures the cruel torment of her classmates. Either or both of these seem to be the trigger for Carrie's gift, and it's the first time we get the flicker of lights, and then shortly after she breaks the water cooler in the principal's office. So I'm calling Carrie's gift that's been dormant inside her is really the monster, and in this case, it's kind of like that poke the bear kind of thing. So whether it's just the fact that she's getting her period and coming of age, or if it's the fact that she's been tormented so horrifically by her classmates that makes the monster come out, I'm not sure. But that to me is the inciting incident of this movie, and it's the inciting attack that really sets us off. The next obligatory scene is a single non-heroic protagonist is thrown out of stasis and forced to pursue a conscious object of desire, saving their own life. So in this case, I feel like Carrie here is also is the victim and the monster. So she starts out as the victim throughout and then gets to, again, in the society aspect, the revolution is when Carrie takes her power and she uses it to get back at everyone. So Carrie's thrown out of stasis when she gets her period. She thinks she's dying. Also, she starts to realize she has these powers. And so she's trying to figure out how to cope with life at home. So all of this, the fact that she gets her period and her mother thinks it's a sin for you to get your period, you know, and she has to kind of manage that whole thing at home now and try to plead her case to her mother. So a speech in praise of the monster. So here, Carrie praises herself to her mother when she reveals her gift and tells her that she's not evil. Other people have this gift. It's genetic. It skips a generation. Grandma had it. Carrie wants to be normal like the other kids at school. So saying that her gift is normal is the highest praise that she can give. And it's the opposite of what her mother is saying, the fact that she's evil, from the devil, she's a witch. So Carrie praises herself by saying that her gift is nothing to be ashamed of. The next obligatory scene is the victim at the mercy of the monster. So here's where the tables really turn. And of course, after the pig blood incident and then Tommy's death, the entire school is at the mercy of Carrie. So this is really where she has her revolution and she takes her power and uses it to get revenge. So a false ending, Carrie returns home from prom seeking the comfort of her mother only to be attacked and stabbed. Carrie kills her mother and then collapses the house on top of them both. So we, you know, there's the huge event that's at the school, which, you know, lasts quite a while. She takes everybody out. She's out on the road and she takes out Chris and her boyfriend in the car. And then she comes home and it really feels like, you know, we have kind of this lower moment. And then she comes home to tell her mother was right, that they were awful to her. And then her mother attacks her rather than comforting her. The final obligatory scene is the protagonist becomes the final victim after a series of kill-off scenes of minor characters. Normally, when we have the list, this one's up, comes before something else. But here, because again, the tables feel very swapped around in this specific story because our victim and our monster live in the same body, Carrie herself is the final victim because she collapses the house on herself and she refuses to leave her mother. And so she accepts this death and she embraces it. And again, when we talk about the values at stake here in a horror story, it goes, you know, from life to death. And the negation of the negation is death would be a mercy, which I feel like is what Carrie reaches here, because she would rather die than have to, you know, face a life without her mother. And because that's all she's known. And so even she can't really handle all of the power that she has. So she chooses death, and it is a mercy. So that's the obligatory scenes and conventions as I see it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Kim, that I mean, we had a whole discussion before we started to record about this film and the genre and the subgenre and exactly who the monster is. As I said at the outset, I don't see Carrie as the monster. Monstrous, yes, in the ending scene, but it speaks further to what Leslie was just saying about the genre and about picking your genre at the beginning and sticking to it and so forth. So the fact that this film incited such discussion in us about who the monster is, what the source of evil is, what are the various scenes. For example, speech in praise of the monster could, in my opinion, if looking at Margaret as the monster, could very simply have been that scene in the principal's office where the principal says, well, we have to call your mom, Carrie. And she is so upset that the water cooler breaks. That, without any words, speaks directly to the power of that villain. You know, the speech in praise doesn't necessarily have to be a big speech, verbal speech talking about, you know, pontificating about how great the villain is. There's a great scene about that in The Incredibles, in the Pixar film The Incredibles. But it can be something as simple, in my opinion, as that, just the water cooler breaking. That is a clear signal to the audience of how powerful that monster is. And I think the fact that we have had so much discussion about who the monster is in this story is further evidence that it's the subgenre of ambiguous as opposed to supernatural or uncanny.
Thanks, Valerie. Yeah, I agree. It's a little bit strange to figure out, like, okay, exactly who the monster is in this one. So, Anne, why don't you take us through the conventions? Maybe you can shed a little more light or put some wisdom on us as well. So,
well, I don't know about wisdom, but I do have thoughts. The first convention of a horror story is that the monster cannot be reasoned with. Possessed by a spirit of evil, it is here to devour and annihilate. There's been plenty of discussion already about who the monster is. I'm going to argue here that the monster is religion. Stephen King himself, when he wrote the book, was struggling with questions of religion. He is not himself an atheist, but I think there was a period early on in the 70s when he was thinking about it and saw problems with religion, and that's what he was writing about in the book. So some remnants of that remain in the movie, even though the movie makers did not think through clearly this question of who the monster is. Religious fanaticism here seems to represent the spirit of evil that consumes Margaret and ruins Carrie's life. The second convention of a monster movie, a horror movie, is conventional settings within a fantastical world. This story takes place in what's supposed to be a typical American high school, complete with absolutely nobody unattractive, and everybody has a pink phone and a comically incompetent principal. But Carrie's fantastical world is locked in this bizarre 1960s era house with home-sewn clothes and a prayer closet full of religious torture pictures. And in Alien, if we look back at Alien as sort of our horror story, the workaday world was this freighter, Nostromo, and its blue-collar denizens, but in space where no one can hear you scream. And here, the ordinary world of high school is Carrie's outer space where no one can hear her scream. The next convention is a labyrinth-like claustrophobic setting, and this certainly, the house that Carrie and Margaret live in certainly meet this criterion, especially the prayer closet, which is dark and creepy and filmed in a claustrophobic way. But additionally, Carrie's internal landscape is really claustrophobic, and everything in the way she moves through the world, the way the actor portrayed her, says that she's locked inside her body. The next convention is perpetual discomfort for characters and the audience. I was certainly uncomfortable all the way through it. The hallways lined with the walk of shame, sniggering, bullying high schoolers, and Carrie's tight, frightened walks of shame are juxtaposed against her increasing powers, which are creepy and uncomfortable for us, although she seems to enjoy them. The highly telegraphed and famous bloody ending makes every scene with Carrie's few supporters feel fraught with dramatic anxiety. We know that she can throw deadly weapons with her mind well before the midpoint shift, and so there's no doubt that everyone else is going to find that out too. Carrie's mom is pure discomfort from beginning to end, creepy for us, creepy for Carrie. She's a burden to herself, and she's constantly trying for self-control. The next convention is the monster's power is masked and progressively revealed. This brings up the question again of who or what is the monster. And I'll just go with, if the monster is Margaret's religious fanaticism or religion itself, her power wanes rather than grows throughout the story. So I don't feel like this convention is really met. Nothing is ever masked about the power from beginning to end, as far as I can film. The next convention is monster remains off stage for as long as possible. This convention applies if the monster is religion or religious belief or fanaticism, because we only get glimpses of it until the ending payoff, when there's a moment where Margaret acts as the preacher to Carrie's congregation and stabs her as part of some ritual. And at that point, the monster, which is Margaret and her religious fanaticism, is fully revealed. But I don't feel like this is really clearly met either. Finally, the use of technology. Victims experience horrific attacks at a remove via screens, radio, or other devices. And this convention is specifically not done. The horrific attacks are viewed through screens, played on big screens through. I mean, we see the attacks ourselves, and we see them on the screens, the phone screens at the same time. So I feel like this convention really was not particularly well met by this movie.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. I mean, it got a little confusing. I agree. You sort of know automatically, okay, something's wrong with Carrie, but I guess maybe it's because I saw the movie or read the book that I already knew what the gig is up. So Valerie, did you want to chime in a little bit on this before you talk about the point of view and the narrative device?
Yeah, I found it really interesting when I started to do a little research on this film that even the filmmakers did not have a clear idea of the genre. The director and the producer and even the stars talked about it as a coming-of-age story, as a science fiction story, as a thriller. So the fact that they didn't have a clear idea of the genre really shows through in the film and in our analysis, because we're all struggling with finding obligatory scenes and conventions, agreeing on external genre, internal genre, and we all have really strong arguments for what we're saying too. And there's, I came up with a different internal genre than Kim, but I can't really argue with what Kim has said either because it's a really strong point. So I think that's, it just further goes to what Sean is always talking about, which is step one, pick your genre and then stick with it. Commit to it throughout the telling of your story. Otherwise, it gets a little confusing and it feels the audience is left feeling unsatisfied or that something was lacking or that it was just sort of a meh kind of experience.
Yeah, I think it's more confused. I felt confused.
And I watched this with my daughter who didn't know anything about the book or the story. So I was watching her reactions throughout because I did know the story. And it was interesting that it wasn't just me who knew the story having those reactions. It was my daughter as well, who sort of saw things coming faster than she should have. Anyway, that leads me into point of view and narrative device. The point of view is third person omniscient. We get to see scenes from Margaret's point of view, Carrie's, Sue's, and Chris's. So the camera just goes wherever it wants and shows us whatever it wants. Narrative drive can be accomplished in three ways in a story. There's dramatic irony, which is when the viewer or reader knows more than the character. Then there's mystery, which is when the character knows more than the viewer or reader. And then there's suspense, which is when the viewer or reader and the character have the same amount of information. Horror stories require suspense. When the reader is in sync with the protagonist, he'll be on the edge of his seat wondering what will happen next. Mystery can work under certain circumstances, but it's harder to pull off. Dramatic irony, however, is the doom of horror stories, because if the reader knows more than the protagonist, he loses interest really quickly. And this version of this story is largely dramatic irony. There is some suspense. Like, for example, the scene with Margaret at the end when Carrie comes home from the prom is suspense. Yes, we see Margaret walk behind Carrie, so it slips into dramatic irony there, but it's only for a minute and it helps to build the tension. We know that Margaret is out of the closet. We assume she's somewhere in the house. And when she walks behind Carrie, that just confirms that she's somewhere in the house. But we are in no way prepared for her to stab Carrie, to try to kill her daughter again, even though that was the very first scene of the story. So we were set up for it, but it was a great payoff because we weren't expecting it because it was an area of suspense. However, most of the story is in a situation of dramatic irony, which really drains the tension from the story. And the biggest example of this is the whole pig's blood thing at the prom. And again, this is where I was watching my daughter, because for me, it's a well-known scene. But for my daughter, she didn't know anything about it. And we see Chris and Billy and the others kill the pig, and we see them setting up the bucket and all that kind of stuff. And you have, I think it's a 15-minute period of time where you're waiting for that bucket to drop on Carrie's head. And what it means is you're not paying attention to what's happening in those 15 minutes. It feels very slow. It feels very draggy. And it feels like the story doesn't pick up again until the bucket has been dumped, because you know what's going to happen. So when Carrie goes up on stage, I know it's meant to be very suspenseful and be very tension filled, but it just wasn't. So yes, all that to say that you need, if you're going to write a horror story, you have to really stay with suspense as your narrative device. And unfortunately, in this story, it didn't. It was largely dramatic irony.
Just a quick mention that the 1976 film and this version of the film from 2013, they're both linear and mostly use standard cinematic point of view. And that both are different from the narrative device within the novel, which was epistolary and nonlinear. So I haven't read the book, but obviously that's one thing to consider. You have lots of options when deciding how to present a story and what kinds of framing devices you use and that sort of thing. So I wanted to make note of that.
Thanks, Leslie. And so question number five. What are the objects of desire, aka wants and needs? And that's back to Valerie.
Yeah, I think this is pretty clear. Carrie wants to belong and to be accepted, and she needs love and understanding from her mother.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, she is, you can just see it in the eye, in her eyes, where she just really wants to belong and she's just so awkward.
Yeah, it really feels like she didn't get what she wants and she certainly didn't get what she needs. And it's just, it's heart-wrenching. We really feel for her.
Yeah, because we all know that person in high school that is sort of awkward. And then turns out they're sort of awkward and then they go out in the real world and they become super successful. And anyway, so high school, I guess what I'm trying to say is what you are in high school does not mean what you are in real life. But anyway, Leslie, did you have another comment?
Yeah, just a quick thing that consistent with the status pathetic internal genre that I would suggest that Carrie's need is to become more sophisticated and to develop a stronger will if she's going to rise in society. And to do that, unfortunately, she needs to have a strong mentor, which she doesn't have in her mom or really anyone else who's consistent in her life, supporting her, giving her good advice and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, even the gym teacher, which you're kind of like, oh, maybe she'll, you know, help her out, ends up, I don't know, maybe it's just Carrie's interpretation of the gym teacher, not as part of the joke. So yeah, really, like, she's just got everything against her. Poor Carrie. Poor Carrie. So question number 6 is, what is the controlling idea/theme? And we're back to Valerie for that one.
Both horror stories and action stories turn on the core value of life and death. However, while action stories stop at death, horror stories have to go to the end of the line, the negation of the negation, which is a fate worse than death. Carrie starts and ends at the negation of the negation. Carrie, Margaret, and even Chris are outsiders who all suffer a fate worse than death. For Carrie, it's isolation. She's isolated at the beginning. She is cyberbullied. She's isolated at the end. And for her, death is a mercy. She would rather die in that house with her mother than endure any more of what she's had to go through. For Margaret, her soul is forever damned for being an abusive mother and trying to kill her daughter. I mean, if you're going to go to hell, that's the thing that's going to get you there, boy. And Chris, she suffers the negation of the negation because she will be forever remembered as a bully who pushed her peer to the breaking point. So, because of all that, I am hypothesizing that the controlling idea is this. A fate worse than death results when society blindly adheres to a belief system that denies love and affection to individuals who are different.
That's good.
Yeah, I like that one a lot.
Woohoo!
I think you nailed it. Well, there's two things. Like, poor Carrie, and then, oh my God, don't mess with Carrie, right? If she could just control that anger, which I know is, I think, part of the monster inside her. Because what's interesting about this is, as I think about it and we discuss it, every single one of us has got the monster inside. Some of us can control it and some of us can't control it. And when given the option to unleash the monster, some of us choose to do that, like Carrie, can't control because she hasn't been the mentor or society sort of reining it in. So yeah, you nailed it. Leslie, what do you think?
My slight tweak to taking into account what I think the internal genre is a fate worse than death results when a weak and naive protagonist lacks the guidance of a strong mentor, which they need to rise in social standing and to control the power within them.
What I like about the story and what I like about both of those controlling ideas, it's a real call. Like, it's the cautionary tale, right? It's a real call to people to be mentors, right? It's a real call to be able to look around and take notice of the people that are different and befriend them intentionally and help them intentionally. And I think that is a really great controlling idea that comes from such a sad film.
Yeah, I think we see this in our society now. There's just a lot of people that are lost and not, like you said, the awkward people, embraced, mentored. You know, even though we are connected, we're not connected. This story really brings that out in a way that, even though it's a little bit hokey on the way it's done and you kind of get confused, it sort of stands the test of time in terms of, like, watch out for the people that you bully, because that could backfire, and not only backfire, but that's just not the way we should run the world. So, but both of those are great. So the final question, which is what we added, which is good examples of screen types, tropes, clear tie-ins to other genres. And for that, Valerie, why don't you lead us off?
Well, the first one we've already talked about, I think, and that is an example of why narrative drive is so important in a story and why, as a writer, you be very careful with which you pick, whether you choose to have a situation where you're in using dramatic irony, or whether you're writing in mystery, or whether you're writing with suspense, because different ones will play differently in different genres. And as I said, in a horror genre, you really want to use suspense. And when you don't, and you're in a situation of dramatic irony, it can really take the wind out of the sails of your story. The second one that I had, we've already touched on as well, and that's why it's so important to pick your genre and commit to it right from the beginning. Carrie is a classic horror novel, but as I said, even the people making the movie didn't know what to call it, whether it was a coming of age or a thriller or a sci-fi. And as a horror story, it doesn't really seem to work well for modern audiences. And this brings me to my third point, which is this is a great example of how not to do a remake. Now, again, through our research, we discovered that Kim Pierce, the director, faced a number of challenges when she was trying to make this movie. So it isn't the version she wanted to tell either. And she freely admitted that the ending didn't work. It's just what she could get approved. We saw this same issue with Jack the Giant Slayer, which was a retelling of the Jack and the Beanstalk story. So if you're going to retell a story that's already known and you're going to make it relevant and resonate with a modern audience, you have to connect it with something that is relevant in society to that audience. So Carrie would have been an excellent opportunity to focus on the issue of cyberbullying, because that is so relevant in today's society. And we actually have situations where teens who have been cyberbullied commit suicide because death is preferable than the fate worse than death, which is what they are enduring day after day. And it would have been so incredible if that had been the focus of this movie. Instead, what we have is essentially a remake of the 1976 Brian De Palma version, which it's a totally different time, with a totally different set of sensibilities. So I think this kind of fell flat a little bit. A prime example where issues facing society have been coupled with a horror genre is the movie Get Out, which used bigotry and issues of race and race relations as the element of horror. And it's a dynamite movie. I highly recommend it. So those would be my three examples.
I just weigh in here to add that if you're going to update a story like this, which it definitely they tried to do, this is a very small thing compared to issues of cyberbullying, but change the character names. Sue, Chris, Billy, these are names two generations old. It's a small thing, but I've had this conversation with clients. Unless you're telling a historical story, check your names. Names, traditions change over time. It's a small thing, but think about it.
Yeah, there's no Chloe, there's no Brittany. Right. So, I mean, yeah, you're totally right. Kim?
Yeah, I wanted to say that the original story that Stephen King wrote and both of the films, it's a great innovation when it comes to the horror genre as far as the victim and the monster are in fact the same person. So if it had been able to be executed the way that Kimberly Pierce wanted it to be before they re-edited it for the actual theatrical release, that it really does play off of the society side, and where you have a weak, you know, victimized person who has that revolution scene and becomes the monster. And so I like that the victim and the monster are actually the same person. And I think that's an interesting innovation for the horror genre. The other thing I wanted to point out about this story is a powerful example of an inciting incident. So the shower scene where, you know, Carrie gets her first period and she doesn't know what it is and she's terrified. She thinks she's bleeding to death and she, you know, is bullied so horribly in that scene. You know, they throw tampons at her and they chant at her and this horrible, horrific thing. And that is an amazing inciting incident. if we talk about ordinary things in, you know, fantastical, you know, you have the fantastical and the ordinary together. Well, there's nothing more ordinary than a girl getting her period. And so to turn that into something that is, in this case, the trigger to her powers being released, it was shocking, and it really does set the tone. It brings in that thematic, the theme of blood. So I just think that's a great example of an inciting incident for a story.
Yeah, I agree. I felt so bad for her. I mean, and they were just merciless and man, just so super mean, super mean. Leslie, you want to wrap it up for us on this section?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that there's an article that talks about Kimberly Pierce's struggles in remaking this film, and with where the studio wanted to make changes, and that led to a lot of the problems that we're seeing with execution, and that the failure, you know, to really innovate the story could possibly be the fault of studio executives who were struggling with the word vagina because.
You're kidding me, right? It's the patriarchy. Oh my God. Another example.
Oh, great.
Like, why are we stuck in 1880? You know? Jeez.
Yeah. So I understand it can be embarrassing to talk about genital parts, but we will do better in society, I think, if we can, you know, actually name them anatomically correctly and have discussions about story and what we're trying to accomplish.
And this is where you have to put in the applause thing.
I can do that.
Sorry. All right. Thanks, everyone. That wraps up this week. Thank you, Anne, Kim, Valerie, and Leslie for your excellent editorial insights into Carrie. We hope our discussion helps you write a better horror story. Links to the Fool's Cap and other materials will be in the show notes. We'd love for you to comment, argue with us on our interpretations, and suggest future movies for us to analyze. You can do this by contacting us on Twitter at StoryGridRT. If you're interested in hiring a certified StoryGrid editor or would like to find out more about what we do, visit storygrid.com/editing. If you want to connect with one of us directly, links to our websites can be found in the show notes. If you'd like to support the show, you can do that by telling other writers and editors about us and by leaving a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Join us again next time when we disappear into the thriller genre with Gillian Flynn's 2014 hit, Gone Girl. Why not give it a look during the week and follow along with us? Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.